Hey everybody, welcome to another Baseball America Prospects podcast. I'm Kyle Glazer alongside Josh Norris.
Howdy.
We are here to talk about one of the best systems in baseball today, the Chicago White Sox. Lots been said and written about their turnaround over the past 18 months, how they've sold off most of their veterans, not all, but most. They've rebuilt with one of the strongest systems in the game. Josh, you had the pleasure of doing the White Sox system this year for the Prospect Handbook. Before we dive into the individual guys, just what's your overall assessment of the system and where it stands among its peers in the game?
It's gotten a lot better, and that's because they've made a lot of smart trades, even with the graduations of Giolito and Lopez and Moncada. This team is still loaded with loaded with talent from trades, including number one prospect Eloy Jimenez, number 10, I believe I put him, Dylan Cease, Michael Kopech is still in there. Guys like that populate their top 10 pretty prolifically.
You know, three of their top five prospects, as you rank them, were acquired in trades, five of their top 10. So there's no question, I think, having, you know, obviously moving guys like Chris Sale, moving guys like Tommy Canley and Todd Frazier, David Robertson, Jose Quintana this year, not David Robertson. Yeah, David Robertson, excuse me. All those trades were done to kind of reset the clock, get the White Sox back on a path to contention in the future. Overall, do you feel like this team has gotten the amount of talent they should have for the quality of players they traded at the major league level?
Absolutely.
I agree, just had to ask.
No, I thought they struck while the iron was hot for Jose Quintana. It helps that he had a really great contract to trade, and you know they got a commensurate return with Eloy Jimenez, one of the top five prospects in the game, and Dylan Cease, almost a wild card, maybe not a super wild card, very high upside kind of guy, and Brian Flatey and Matt Rose as well, who are on depth charts. And from the Yankees, they got Blake Rutherford and Tito Polo and... who am I missing here? Oh, Ian Clark and Tyler Clippard. So they've got guys throughout the system that, you know, that ranked in other guys' systems in their 30s and 10s as well. And they still have chips to trade in Evesel Garcia if they so choose.
Jose Abreu
if they so choose.
So, Josh, I want to take you back 25 years ago.
Well, I'm 7 years old.
The year is 1993.
Mm-hmm.
Power hitter by the name of Frank Thomas is the American League MVP for the Chicago White Sox.
Heard of him.
And a thinner right-hander who is nonetheless a top draft pick and a very well-renowned pitcher named Jack McDowell is the American League Cy Young Award winner. The White Sox had your MVP and your Cy Young Award winner in the same year. Do you think there's a future here, whether it's 3 years from now, 4 years from now, 5 years from now, where that's Eloy Jimenez and Michael Kopech?
I could see it. I'm more confident on Eloy than I am on Kopech. White Sox Twitter is going to yell at me over that. But, you know, Eloy, yeah, I could see him winning an MVP or two down the line. But, and Kopech certainly could possess that type of stuff down the line, or could put together that type of season down the line. I don't know if I'm ready to call Eloy Frank Thomas just yet, but he's going to have some fun. Even an outside evaluator said, you know, this guy's going to hit 250, 350 home runs in the big leagues. And that might be selling him short.
No, the guy can absolutely mash. Again, one of those guys, I've seen him play perfectly fine right field, whether it's right field, left field.
We saw him flip over a bullpen.
It's not going to matter. This guy is, he can do both. He can play the corner outfield just fine. He's going to mash. I think White Sox fans have a lot to be excited about. Just a guy that...
They're pretty certain he's going to be a left fielder, Eloy.
And that's perfectly fine. I think, you know, a lot of times we see, particularly in discussions of prospects, people obsess over positional value. And there's definitely prospects where, yes, you need to take it into account. But as I've repeated many times over, Paul Goldschmidt's one of the 10 best players in baseball the last 5 years. The fact he plays first base doesn't do anything to take away from that. Mike Trout's a center fielder. If he played left field, he'd still be the best player in baseball, period. There's certain guys who are great talents. They're going to be studs no matter what position they trot out to on the field. Eloy, to me, is one of those guys. The fact he's going to play left field, and he'll be totally fine there, does not change the fact this is one of the top five prospects I would start a farm system with.
Yeah, Albert Pujols also comes to mind. Older incarnation of Albert Pujols, but yes.
I guess Manny Ramirez would be the other, you know, yeah, left fielder. Yes. But not saying Eloy is Manny Ramirez.
Although some people have said that.
Again, he's a special talent. We'll see how it comes together. He got his first taste of Double A last year. He'll be in Triple A, presumably middle to end of this year. I don't know. Do you see an Eloy White Sox ETA anytime this year, or do you think it's purely 2019?
I would hedge on 2019, especially if they don't think they're going to contend. You know, I don't think another full year in the minor leagues could kill him. But, you know, he could bully his way up there.
And that's the big thing to remember, that obviously this is a tremendously talented individual with a bright future ahead. He's also had some injury issues, and he has 18 games above A-ball in his career.
Yeah, you know, let's let him cook for a little more.
Right, he's 21 years old, just turned 21 here at the end of November. Still a young guy, because he's going to play all next year at age 21. Double-A, triple-A circuit, and we'll see what happens. There is a pretty high level of confidence that, hey, Eloy Jimenez, this is a dude, you know, you don't have to worry about, as long as he stays healthy, of course. Mm-hmm. You really don't, there's not a lot of people saying, oh, I don't know. There's a fairly high level of confidence that this guy's going to be, you know, an impact, middle of the order, you know, all-star type bat. Mm-hmm. Michael Kopech's interesting because with him, even though he's advanced to higher levels and, you know, performed at higher levels, taking relative, you know, pitcher versus hitter contributions into account, there's a lot more questions. And I think a lot of that's just a function of this is a guy who has a history of wildness. He also had a couple of issues, getting into a fight with a teammate. There was a positive drug test in there earlier in his career. So I think that people still have some hesitation there. What was your sense, you know, talking to evaluators about Michael Kopech? We saw his control really tick up at the end of last season, made some adjustments, finishing more online in his delivery. Talking to evaluators and people both inside and outside the organization, what was the sense you got on Kopech and what strides he's made and what more he needs to make?
I mean, the sky's the limit for Michael Kopech. He's got the big-time fastball up to, you know, 103 or however high in triple digits he's hit. He's got the big-time slider that can be an out pitch. He needs to refine the changeup. They want him to not go 100% on every pitch every time because, you know, that'll tire you out pretty quick. They want him to learn to, you know, maybe go 75, 80%. And that's why they gave him a two-seamer this year because, as one official explained to me, if you overthrow that two-seamer, you're going to spike it. And if you learn how to not spike that, maybe you can translate it to all your other pitches and save some bullets for later in the game. They need to refine his command. Like you said, stay online a little bit more. But the raw tools are there, and that's why I ranked him number two.
You know, one of the things that I think is just most encouraging to me, if you look at the end of the year, his final nine starts, he had a 1.29 ERA. That included finishing up double-A, triple-A. But most importantly, 71 strikeouts to 12 walks in 56 innings.
Yeah, he's a bad man when he's on.
But that's the breakthrough everyone was looking for. Because you saw earlier in the year, he still had low ERAs. He was still missing a lot of bats. But there were games of four walks, three strikeouts. Even his 8 to 10 strikeout games, there's 4 walks, 5 walks. We all know you can't allow free base runners in the major leagues. If you do, it's going to come back to bite you. And it seems like, you know, you talk about a kid who you're waiting for him to make the stride. You're waiting for him to make the stride, and he made it. And importantly, what it led to as well, a lot longer outings. You know, earlier in the year, he got past the sixth inning once. By the end of the year, he got past the sixth inning in 4 of his final 5 starts in Double-A. He went 8 innings, then 6, then 7. He's lasting longer. He's more efficient. He's just been better. The breakthrough, I think, we saw it come to fruition.
Yeah. I mean, he's, like I said, he's really, really, really good when he's on. And I'm very interested to see what he does in a full-ish season at AAA, where the hitters will bite you if you're not commanding the ball. I don't care how hard you throw. There are some, you know, major league veterans lurking, waiting to get you and tell you who you are.
You know, I think it's fair to say he'll get a full season in AAA this year, or close to it.
Yep.
And we'll see how it goes. You know, Jimenez and Kopech are pretty clear number one, number two. And in that order, I assume there wasn't much debate there.
No.
The next group, you have Alec Hansen, Luis Robert, Dane Dunning, Zach Collins. Take us through, you know, who was in the running for that number three spot and ultimately what led you to go with Alec Hansen there?
It was the only two guys that were in consideration for that spot were Robert and Hansen. And I think they're really not 3-4 so much as they are 3 and 3.5. initially, I had Robert there because the tool package is magnificent. It's you know, a guy who could possibly stick in center field. There's power. There's hitability. There's blinding speed. There's everything you want. There's a reason he got like $26 million. But at the same time, Alec Hansen also was second in the minor leagues in strikeouts this year, did it obviously at higher levels, and is just a little closer. So that's why I went with Hansen over Robert.
but I would like to have both prospects in my system. Hanson, you know, took some strides forward this year. They're working on getting him more toward the plate this year, keeping his front shoulder level with his back shoulder and his delivery, and making sure the consistency of his stuff stays there, because when it's on, it's really, really good. I saw him once this year against a Potomac team which had Michael A. Taylor in their lineup. I think he struck him out 4 times on 16 pitches. He took him apart.
Now, one of the things with Hanson is he's 6'7", 255 pounds. He's a big dude. And we've seen a lot of times pitchers that big, a lot of the times they have trouble repeating, and that, you know, lends itself to a lot of wildness. What was the sense you got from evaluators about their confidence level in him being able to throw strikes consistently? Because that's always been the rub.
And that was kind of what internally the White Sox brought up. Like I said, they want him to keep those shoulders even and stay on line to the plate a little more.
Well, I know that's what they want him to do, but how much confidence is there that he can do it?
He got all the confidence in the world that he can do it. Otherwise, they wouldn't have taken it.
Let me rephrase. Outside evaluators. I mean, was there obviously internally teams are going to be off. They're not going to tell you, oh, we don't believe in this guy.
No, I don't think there was a huge pushback outside either, simply because I ranked him number 3. If there was a big pushback, I probably would have popped him a little lower than I did.
You know, we have our discussions here at Baseball America quite frequently, and Ben Bowler brought up something interesting, kind of a career path. Now, a different pitcher, different size, different profile. But he mentioned Garrett Richards as a guy who, you know, put up poor numbers in college, coincidentally, or not, at University of Oklahoma, same school as Alec Hanson. You know, just it never quite clicked for him there, and we saw it didn't click for Hanson his final year there. And eventually Richards was able to work himself into a frontline starter. Now, it took some time. Obviously, he really blossomed as a true ace type here in 2014, 2015. He's been hurt the last 2 years. But it took time. You know, 2011, 2012, 2013, he was bouncing back and forth, starting and relieving. It was a lot of middling performance. It wasn't until his age 26 season he really blossomed. Do you see a similar situation with Hanson where it might, just because he's had some of those issues in the past, it might take some time, but he can eventually get there? It just won't be at age 23, 24. It might be 26, 27.
I mean, I could see it, but I wouldn't bet on it. He seems to be stuff-wise past the senioritis or draftitis and all the complications that had him kind of drop in the draft at Oklahoma. Remember, this was a guy who was in consideration, at least in our office, for 1-1 his draft year. So it's never been a question of the stuff, and it showed up this year. We'll see what upper-level hitters do to him this year. He had a little bit of a taste of it last year at Birmingham, but I don't think it will take quite that long.
Again, small sample size. Went up to Birmingham, 17 strikeouts and 3 walks and 10 in the third innings. Now, there were 15 hits allowed, but, again, showed the ability to miss bats, keep the ball in the strike zone, which has been his bugaboo. It's a promising thing. Obviously, a fantastic year at both A levels. You mentioned Luis Robert was 3.5. Obviously, you know, everything is one of those guys that, because he hasn't been to the States yet, the big money, it's almost a mythology. And sometimes we have to separate out, okay, what's real versus what's not. I remember at the winter meetings, Rick Renteria, the White Sox manager, talked to us and said he went down to the Dominican complex and was just blown away by this kid. Absolutely blown out of the water. What were the type of things you were hearing about him and his first taste of professional baseball down in the Dominican?
I mean, he was also dinged a little bit down there, but the tools were online with Yoan Moncada's. So, you know, if that gives you a baseline to judge by, he's very, very good. And they're considering starting him at high class A this year, you know, jumping him over both, you know, Great Falls and Kannapolis. Yeah,
he's an older guy. It's like he's 17, he's 20, he'll be 21 next year. And as Ben Bowler, our great international guru, pointed out, a lot of times teams will do that for tax purposes, starting exactly the DSL. So it wasn't really an ability level thing, it was more of a tax thing.
Right, and he's going to be in a crowded mix this year at A ball. They have, and I think Future Sox pointed that out too, and it was something that they're. Their internal guys pointed out to me as well that, you know, they have Robert, Luis Gonzalez, Mike Rodolfo, Blake Rutherford, Alex Call, all these guys who are going to be in the mix for, you know, that's 5 guys I named, for spots at the Winston-Salem outfield. So they've got a good problem to have at the lower levels with, you know, 5 higher-end prospects who could be in the mix to play high A this year.
it's definitely going to be a very, very talented team. Ultimately, you know, it's a lot of room to go, but what is the, you know, scenario that evaluators envision Robert blossoming into?
Give me a top five prospect in the game.
I'm talking about beyond just prospect success, what kind of major leaguer?
Perennial all-star. I mean, he has as high a ceiling as anybody in this system.
And it's interesting you say that, because, I mean, I think Eloy is considered to be, no, that guy, that the highest ceiling. Would Robert, is there a ceiling?
Well, you could have him in center field and an excellent offensive output, too. You'd have center field-type defense. If you added center field defense to Robert, or to Eloy, you got a really even better prospect.
That would certainly be spectacular. Obviously, a lot of steps to go, but we'll see if he can get there. Next group. A couple of interesting guys. Dane Dunning came over in the Adam Eaton deal, had a nice debut year. Zach Collins split a couple people. He had Jake Berger, first rounder, who also splits a few people. Blake Rutherford, first rounder a year ago, came over in the Yankees trade. A down year. Overall, just what was kind of your sense on this group here and where they all are? It seems like it's a lot of split type guys. Dunning less so, but Collins, Berger, Rutherford, even Gavin Sheets to a degree.
I mean, Dunning is the safest of that group, I think, because he's going to be a mid-rotation type sinker slider, not going to strike out the world necessarily. They wanted to tweak a little bit with his delivery this year. I cursed him. I should never watch him again, because when I watched him, he got hit by line drives. Yes. And then tried to pitch with them. It was great. But Dunning, you know, he was a sorcerer at Kannapolis this year. I mean, you can go look at his numbers there, and he was, you know, I couldn't do that on a video game.
Yeah.
Be cliche and talk about how terrible I am at video games. But he was pretty darn good, too, at Winston-Salem.
135 strikeouts, 36 walks, 118 innings. ERA was a little elevated, and part of that was home runs. That's the one thing you can look at and say, you'll get 15 homers and 118 innings this year at Winston.
Winston is a hitter's haven. I mean, take a look at some of the hitter splits there from the White Sox. And B, that'll happen when you sink the ball and you don't get the sink you're looking for. If your stuff flattens out, it's going to go far. And that was something they wanted the more consistency in his mechanics to avoid the sink on the ball. To induce the sink on the ball.
You know, ultimately, you know, we saw Giolito and Lopez make the ascension last year. Is the idea, do you see, you know, Dunning, Kopech will presumably be there next. I mean, are Dunning and Hanson, I mean, is that the final two pieces? Is that the White Sox rotation?
In theory, yeah. Yeah, them, those Giolito, Lopez, Dunning, Hanson.
Kopech.
Yeah, I think that's how I put them in my 2021 lineup.
Should be an interesting group. Zach Collins was their first rounder last year.
Right. So
I know you saw him a lot, talked about him a lot.
Zach Collins, so for these top 30 capsules, we're supposed to write like 175 to 200 words. When I finished my capsule, I'd written 450 words on Zach Collins and had to cut a lot out of it. That was how much I did digging on Zach Collins.
What did you find?
There are a lot of guys outside the organization who question his ability to catch. It got a lot better this year. As the year went on, there's still work to go. He's got a strong enough arm, but the footwork when he goes to throw needs to be cleaned up a little bit. He needs to work on framing balls a little bit better, receiving them. He will drag balls outside the zone. He needs to block and receive better. There's a long way to go, I think. Not as long as it was to start the year, but there's ways to go for him to be a consistent major league catcher. Now, offensively, he had not the greatest year at Winston-Salem. He had been in Winston-Salem for many, many at-bats. Let's see, what is he at?
426 plate appearances.
Yeah, Winston-Salem over the course of 2 years. He does strike out a ton.
Going back to the year before as well, is another 153. Yeah. So you're looking at nearly 600 at-bats at Winston-Salem, 579 plate appearances at Winston-Salem.
Right. And, you know, one of the things he cleaned up at the end of this year in Strux was a giant hand hitch at the beginning of his swing that when you looked at it and when the scouts looked at it, they said, you know, people are going to get inside on him with fastballs with this hitch, and he's never going to hit for a high average or maybe not necessarily even pull the ball with authority. Once he started smoothing that out,
he started being able to drive inside fastballs a little bit better. And in Instructs, they kind of installed a different swing with him where it's kind of flat on his back, flat on his shoulder, and then pointed, and then he goes, rather than cocking it and pointing it and then bringing it back to launch. So there's obviously power there. There's obviously a little bit below average defense there. It's going to be a work in progress, and he's got the tools to be an offensive major league catcher.
It's interesting. Was Zach Collins here at Buies Creek? When he was in Winston-Salem, he'd come over and play Buies Creek in Carolina. Got to see him a good bit. And one of the things I did like about him, his strike zone discipline was obviously elite. And beyond that, I also remember there was a moment, a particular game where, you know, it takes a fastball 3 inches outside. I mean, clear as day. And the ump calls a strike. And Collins just looks at him and was like, really? And then another one comes. The ump calls the same pitch again. Collins just looks back and was like, really? That's a strike? Okay. So naturally, the pitcher goes back to that same pitch. Collins takes it and just drills it for an opposite field double. You know, and I liked them. I was like, fine, that's a strike? Okay, I'll hit it. I definitely saw the bat-to-ball ability there. Anything out over the plate, this is a guy who can drive it up the middle. Both, you know, didn't see him pull the ball a ton, which is always something you kind of want to see. But, again, up the middle power, opposite field power. So I do think you did see in the bat-to-ball skills and the power in there in spurts. It's just a matter of getting it consistently. You mentioned the swing changes. And look, I think when you talk about guys as a catcher, you know, you saw it in the Futures game, right? Chance Sisko is another guy that left-hand hitting catcher. People have questioned the catching. Well, you watched him in the Futures game, and he was light years ahead of Zach Collins. His receiving, his hands, you know, and that was partially why as soon as Sisko left the game and Collins came in, a lot of the pitchers, the U.S. pitching staff got hit a little bit. You could see a night and day difference. But, like you said, there's some things there you can say, okay, if he can work on it a year or two. But again, that just, you know, for me, that's sort of the thing with Zach Collins, right? I do believe in the bat more than some others. The receiving, the blocking, all that, it's very problematic. And do you make him a DH? Do you make him a first baseman? It's going to be interesting to see. I think this is a critical year for Zach Collins and his defense. And because if it just gets a little bit better, it's probably not going to cut it. If it gets a lot better, and he absolutely has the ability to do it, then we can see something really promising.
Yeah.
All right. As we move down a little bit, you know, one guy, I saw two guys, they're two first round picks last year, Jake Berger and Gavin Sheets. Sheets was second rounder, I'm sorry. Mm-hmm. I saw both of them. I saw Berger when he was with Team USA. And I saw Sheets. I just went out for a Wake Forest USC game because why not?
Saw him hit three home runs.
I saw him hit three home runs. Now, Wake Forest is a bandbox, and the wind was blowing out. But three home runs are three home runs, and you definitely saw the pop there. That was interesting. They went with two corner guys with big power. They're definitely building some power in this offense. Eloy Jimenez, obviously, big power. Zach Collins shows you a decent amount of power. Draft Berger and Sheets. Robert, everyone thinks he's a physical guy with power. It's interesting to me. They're definitely going for the bigger physical guys with pop, it seems like.
Right. You know, they've got speedy guys. They've got Robert. They've got guys like...
But Robert's power, too, which makes him unique.
Yes, yeah. Speed power. You know, those were the... I guess those were the two guys on the board that they let... the best two guys on the board, they thought. And I think you're going to see a lot of power out of them this year because they're going to play at Winston-Salem, and they're going to knock the living crap out of the ball at that park. And you're going to get them on, you know, full seasons. Gavin Sheets was probably worn down some. He was worn down some. I heard outside scouts, inside scouts tell me he was worn down some because Wake Forest played into the Supers.
Right, they went deep into the college postseason. And by the time he actually signed and got there, he had already played a ton of games, and he had another 56 games of pro ball. Yeah.
And Berger, you know, he has some work to do defensively. I've heard some people call him a bit of a dancing bear over there, which I like. Thank you. But another one I've heard was Fred Flintstone. But another word I've heard over there is captain. I've heard at least two people mention the makeup is worthy of a captaincy at the major league level if he gets there. And you know, he stayed in Arizona this year in the offseason to work on his body some just at the White Sox complex all offseason. It's not something you necessarily see from a first-year guy. Especially coming off a college season. But he's another guy that if he stays over there and profiles the way the White Sox and outside evaluators think, you've got a prototypical third baseman.
You know, it's interesting. part of the discussion we have when we look at organizations, the organization talent rankings, it's better to have five great prospects than, you know, 15, they're okay prospects.
Having right, because then you have the great prospects.
Slanted at the top is better. But what separated the White Sox, and I don't know, at least surprised me a little bit when you actually saw it, you know, put on paper. The White Sox top 10, you stack it up with the Padres, the Braves, the Yankees, and I take it. I probably take it, if not number one of those 10, then maybe, you know, it's right there. It's not fourth out of that group. But what was interesting to me is you look at laid out, and you can see this in the prospect handbook, is it really drops off after, yes, you know, you could say, you could say, you know, some people say at 12. To me, it's after number 15. You know, the top 15, okay, you know, number 15, who you'll see who it is in the prospect handbook, is still a guy who, you know, good draft pedigree, first year didn't go as great as some people wanted, but still a nice prospect. After that, it really drops off a cliff, which surprised me.
You know, it does. But I think it could hit a trampoline and bounce back up that cliff if you've got a guy like Luis Alexander Basabe, who came over in the sale trade, and he spent a lot of the year dealing with knee issues, and there were some hit tool questions too. But he's a toolbox, and if he's recovered from that knee surgery this year, you could see a different player in high class A. Mike Rodolfo was the same way. He started to put it together this year. Someone gave him a 110 on the 20/80 scale as far as his arm goes. He's got power potential, but he broke his hand toward the end of the year when he punched a wall. So he missed some development time too. He's another guy who's going to be in the mix for that that Winston-Salem outfield. So there's potential here. There just hasn't been necessarily production. Alex Call is another guy who had some injury troubles this year who could also be at Winston-Salem. Ian Clarkin has dealt, I mean, I do the Yankees and the White Sox. Ian Clarkin has never been healthy, and there's, you know, there's back-end starter potential if he does stay healthy. But we did skip over a guy that I do want to talk about, and that's Blake Rutherford.
Oh, back up the top eight.
Number eight, yeah.
Another guy came up, same deal as Ian Clarkin.
I talked about
Southern California Yankees draft. They love their Southern California high school kids.
Yes, yeah. Yes, they do. James Caprillion, too. I don't know if that's
Southern college, yeah. But UCLA. But, oh, yeah, Nolan Martinez and Drew Finley and Matt Sauer last year. The Yankees are all about drafting high school kids from Southern California.
But with Rutherford, you know, like I said, I do both those systems, and I was probably higher on Rutherford than most in pro ball because I think he hit about 800 in the games that I watched, so that'll bias a guy. But the question with him is power. He's got a very pretty left-handed swing. I think he was getting frustrated a little bit this year that he wasn't having quite the year he wanted. But you know, they had on the teams that they had him on, there was also Floreal, and it was very clear Floreal was the better prospect of those two. So for Rutherford, and even when I was with the Yankees, when I talked to him last year at spring training, his goal was to put on more good weight and get some sock behind the ball in that left hand. I've seen him do it. I've seen him turn on balls. The last swing I saw in spring training this year was Rutherford, and he hit it to the moon, and you know, as I was walking out. So it's in there. He just needs to unlock it a little more. If he does that, he'll improve his stock greatly because the hit tool is there. Otherwise, you're going to have a profile problem because he's a corner outfielder. No doubt. And without power, I don't know what you do with that.
Well, it's interesting. So you mentioned the hitting ability, but this was a guy who hit 260 this year. Obviously, the quality of contact in terms of ability to drive the ball because, you know, again, a part of being, you know, talk about the hit grade, it's, you know, making authoritative contact. And this is a guy who, for a lot of this year, was not putting, you know, the bat on the ball to a emphatic degree. And then some of that's power, but some of it's also just the ability to drive the ball on a line with authority. What is it about Blake Rutherford and what he, you know, what the reports were that makes you say, hey, I still believe the hitting ability is there and it's not, you know, obviously the power is not there, but I think there's also some disappointment with just the overall hit ability overall.
I think, quite frankly, he was, and scouts I talked to think he was pressing, but he, you know, he comes into his first full season in pro ball with all this first round, top whatever prospect hype. I think he was third in the Yankee system entering the 2017 season, and it just wasn't happening for him. That Charleston's murder on left-handers and hitters in general. So that probably didn't help either. But you combine those two factors, and you might not have the start you wanted. But the White Sox still liked him enough out of the draft, and in their evaluations this year that they had him as the centerpiece of that Robertson, Canely, Frazier deal.
It'll be interesting. I think this is undeniably a big year for Blake Rutherford. After he was acquired, went to Kannapolis, dropped even more, 213, yeah, 289, 254. You know, gets a full offseason in the White Sox system now, works with the new coaches, gets into spring with them. I'll be interested to see. I mean, I don't think this is a guy you jump ship on. You know, I saw him and he was a prep in Southern California and he was a very gifted hitter. It was pretty obvious he was going to be a left fielder. I never really understood the individuals who thought he was a center fielder profile. He was never that. He's a left fielder, but you didn't doubt that he could hit enough to make it work. Obviously, hasn't kind of translated in pro ball because, hey, pro ball's hard. One thing to keep in mind is he is an older guy. He was a high school pick, but he's going to be 21 this May. So, you know, you kind of want to see it start to click this year, at least move in the right direction. I'm not saying he has to bounce back and have a crazy campaign, but you do want to start seeing it move in the right direction.
And I'll say it again, fifth verse, same as the first. He's going to be playing in high class A Winston-Salem, probably, and that ballpark will help your offense a lot.
There's definitely that opportunity there. Overall, you know, you mentioned a couple guys. Do you have any sleepers in this system? You know, guys in the back half are not on the list that you think, you know, this time next year White Sox fans are going to know and be pretty excited about?
Let me say this. White Sox fans are legion. They know all about all of their prospects. I am not going to trick anybody here. I like Ian Hamilton. He was a starter at Washington State and a pretty vanilla one. But in the bullpen, he's, you know, 99 miles an hour with a 94-mile-an-hour slider, and he could move up this list very quickly and be kind of an impact bullpen guy. Sebi Zavala, who I can see you typing into your search bar here in Google.
A little bit San Diego State, saw him in the fall league. There's something there.
Pop quiz, even with Eloy Jimenez in that system, he led the system in home runs with, it was like 24 home runs, I think.
21.
I gave him three more. You're welcome, Sebi. He's got the power. He's a lot older. And he was a left fielder for part of the time at San Diego State, if I remember correctly. He's had Tommy John. And if he's got that kind of power and you're a catcher, you're pretty good. He's a tick behind Collins defensively, from what I've heard, and a tick offensively behind Collins, from what I've heard. So this could be an offensive backup.
We'll see what happens. Again, he looked pretty good in the fall league. Hit 326, 407, 435 there. A couple doubles, home run. You know, didn't get a ton of at bats, but played well when he did. And that's a guy you look at. We always see catchers rise higher than maybe a lot of people expect them to. And he's definitely a guy I think who has that possibility.
Yeah, he's an interesting one. We got Ian Hamilton. Who else we got on this list that I like?
Well, I do want to ask your opinion of Tygo Vieira. I mean, this is a guy who throws a million miles an hour.
Yeah, he throws a million miles an hour. They've got three guys on this list who've touched 100, 203.
You know, it's interesting. We talked about physicality and power on the offensive side. They clearly have targeted.
When we skipped Zach Birdie, who...
Right, with velocity, TJ, but yeah. Tell me about Kopech, Birdie, Vieira. I mean, those are three of the hardest throwers in the minors.
Yeah, if he can get an off-speed pitch to consistently click and command... He made his major league debut this year.
Yes.
He can be a lockdown guy. There's a little bit of a couple hurdles to go through, but I've seen him at his best, and it was pretty darn good.
So here's the real question now, Josh. And I think, you know, we talk all about the farm system and you know, where they are and how good it is. But, again, the entire point of this is you don't build a farm system just to build a farm system. You build a farm system to win games at the major league level. That's what matters. That's what counts. That's my question to you. The White Sox now have, it's been a while since they've won games at the major league level at a consistent basis. They are going on their, let's see, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. They have 5 consecutive losing seasons. How much longer will it be before we see this farm system get to the majors, and not only just get there, but make it so this streak of losing seasons ends?
Well, we've seen the first wave get there in Lopez and Giolito and Moncada. Now they're in the point where they've stocked their farm system enough where they can begin to sort out what they have. And this is where the Yankees were, I believe, last couple of years. They can sort out what they have from their depth and use it to trade for studs. They were in, allegedly, on Manny Machado for a while, and I certainly think they have the pieces to do that if the Orioles are so inclined. Now you start to evaluate internally and see what you can do with the prospects, because they're not all going to be White Sox major leaguers. That 2021 rotation we talked about is probably not going to happen, because I don't remember the last time we had five, you know, homegrown guys in a rotation. I'm sure someone will hear this podcast and tell me exactly what the last time we had five homegrown guys in a rotation.
Guys get traded, guys get hurt, pitchers especially.
Right. Now, we're going to see what they can do with it. It's a very good position to be in.
But you're dancing around the question. Give me a year. When do the White Sox have a winning record?
What year is this, 18? Let's go 19.
All right, 2019 winning record.
Mark it down. Put it in your most permanent of markers. Etch it in stone. Save it to your cloud. You know, 2019.
All right, you heard it from Josh Norris. On that note, I think we'll wrap this up. Josh, thank you so much for joining us. Folks, make sure and get your copy of the Baseball America Prospect Handbook. If you order from baseballamerica.com/store, you'll get the supplement with a number 31 prospect. So extra White Sox prospects for all you White Sox prospect junkies. I know there's a lot of you out there.
You are legion.
And we appreciate you taking the time to listen. For Josh Norris, I'm Kyle Glazer. Thanks for listening, everybody.
Bye.